I only have the one medal. Well, Smith, here it is. You might as well take it. I can have others sent up here for the rest of you. Smith held his words inside, fought the temptation to tell Ormond just where to put the medal. Beside him, Bowser leaned in closer, said, "Sir, how about Colonel Beale?" Smith smiled to himself, said, "General Ormond, as much as my senior officers and I appreciate your gesture, we can wait for another day. However, I would very much prefer to see Lieutenant Colonel Olin Beale receive that medal. He was in command of our efforts to rescue a good many survivors of Task Force Faith. Pulled in a sizable amount of the battalion right off the ice under the nose of Chinese snipers. Exemplary job. Beale, huh? Sounds good. Newspapers will like that. Take some of the sting out of the reports about Faith's, problems. Find him for me, will you?" Smith looked at Bowser, who moved away quickly. Ormond looked again toward the small gathering of Marines, as though hoping once more for an audience. Smith felt the cold slicing through every seam in the coat, said, "Sir, might we move this inside?" Ormond weighed the request for a long second. "No, this won't take long, and my aircraft is waiting. I told the boy to keep the engine running. Helps with the heat." Ormond seemed to have a sudden thought. "My chief of staff, General Ruffner, tells me you're removing your dead from here, taking up a good bit of space on the cargo planes. That a wise move?"
"It's the only move. I'll not leave anyone behind if I can help it. These men deserve a proper burial."
Ormond shrugged, seemed unwilling to argue the point. Smith had already received a protest from Ruffner, paid no attention to the man's reasoning that such cargo was taking up space from goods far more useful. If either Ruffner or Ormond decided to blow this into something larger, Smith knew that the reporters would leap on the story, and Ormond would lose. Smith was becoming miserable now, had forgotten his thick wool hat. "General, I'm going back inside. If you require my presence for your ceremony, I'll return." He didn't wait for a response, moved toward his quarters, Sexton opening the door. Smith said, "I suppose it makes him more of a warrior if he stands out there and gets frostbite. Colonel Beale can have his medal. He earned it." Sexton hung the coat up beside the door, said, "Sir, when Colonel Beale finds out he's getting his medal by listening to some speech out in that wind, he might teach General Ormond a few words the Army's not heard before." Hagaru Re, December 5th, 1950, 10 a.m. The staff saw her first, Smith detecting a low whistle from the house's main room. He looked out that way, heard another whistle, and now Sexton, eyes wide, standing in his doorway. "Sir, you're not going to believe this. That dame is here." Smith had no patience for mysteries, said, "What dame?" He heard the door now, the creak of the hinges, a hard slam, a chorus of voices, and one particular voice responding to the obvious attention. It belonged to a woman. Sexton glanced behind him, held the stare for a long second, then looked back at Smith. "This dame, sir." She was there now, no formal request, just pushing past Sexton as though he was merely in the way.
"Maggie Higgins, General, New York Herald Tribune. Mind if I sit in on a few of your discussions? I like to go right to the heart of it."
Smith felt pressed back in his chair, her presence as full of energy as anything he had felt from Chesty Puller. She was tall, younger than he expected, and even in fatigues, Smith could see why the men reacted to her. For men who had not seen anything female in weeks, she fit the definition perfectly.
"Miss Higgins, I had heard you were in the theater. I didn't think you'd land here. This isn't exactly the kind of place I'd expect a woman—"
"I knew you'd throw that at me. Let me tell you something, General. I'm just as capable and just as willing to take risks as any man in the press pool. I've interviewed boys while they were bleeding or being shot at. They didn't give me a Pulitzer Prize because I've got great legs. I hope you don't intend to keep me from doing my job."
He felt overwhelmed, sat up straight. Behind her, he could see a variety of faces, his aides,
overwhelmed in ways of their own. He stood, tugged at his jacket, his brain screaming caution.
Miss Higgins, I have far more to worry about than a flock of reporters, but that doesn't mean you are not my responsibility.
I intend to march out of here with your men. It's the best way I can get an accurate story of what their experiences have been like. The American people are begging for the story, just what it has been like for these men. It's no secret that this could have been a very different kind of story. A post-mortem. The men who fought their way out of certain disaster deserve to have their stories told.
You may write whatever you please, but you will not march alongside my men.
She seemed to grow angrier now, hands on her hips. You would discriminate against me because I am a woman? I expected as much. He let out a breath, glanced up behind her, hoping to see Bowser.
Miss Higgins, it is precisely because you are a woman that I cannot have you marching in column with my men.
She made a sound, was red-faced now, and he felt a surge of desperation, called out,
Where is Colonel Bowser? Find him!
Is my being a woman a threat to you, General? Do you feel I am too fragile to march? He felt anger himself now, took a deep breath, the word rolling over again in his brain.
Careful. Miss Higgins, I am not threatened by you or any other woman, except perhaps my wife when she's royally angry. I am well aware that you being here is a distraction, as are you. My men have a difficult job in front of them that will very likely involve heavy combat. There will also be casualties due to the cold, frostbite cases, and whatnot. Should you become injured in any way, I know how my men will respond. Their attention will be diverted. They will do all they can to ensure your safety, or they will compete to see who will take care of you. I am sure that these men would go to any length to take care of you, and we haven't time for that kind of business. Such a distraction could be dangerous, if not to you, then to my men. I won't have it. You will board the next plane out of here.
Bowser was laughing, and Smith held his scowl, was in no mood for it.
Where were you?
I came as soon as they found me, but you appear to have weathered the storm. Smith jabbed the pipe into his mouth.
She'll write this up, you know. Paint a picture of me like some sort of barbarian. We don't need this kind of nonsense, Alpha. Not one bit.
Bowser laughed again. We're Marines, sir. To most people that makes us barbarians.
No harm will come, surely. She wanted to go out with the troops. Can you see that? These men haven't seen an American woman in ages.
She's a comely lass, too. Oh, there would be fistfights, I'm sure. Smith looked at him, still a scowl.
Nothing's funny about this, Colonel.
Bowser looked down, stifled the smile.
I apologize, sir.
But you have to admit she added a little spice to your day.
I don't admit any such thing. Make sure she gets on that plane. She's taking up a wounded man's space. Somebody down there should have stopped her before now.
I don't think anyone had the guts. Smith felt his anger calming, Bowser's good humor contagious. He tasted the pipe, allowed himself to enjoy the smoke, and Bowser said, She's spitting mad, that's for sure, but she'll get over it. I heard the other reporters talking about her. None of them are as fired up to march out of here as she is. I'm guessing she'll be waiting for us down the road a ways.
Smith pulled the pipe from his mouth. Where?
Well, the rest of them are mostly going to Kodo-Ri. I imagine she'll do the same.
Bowser laughed again, and Smith knew why, the scene forming in his mind.
I'd love to be there to see it, sir. I wonder if she'll march into Colonel Puller's HQ with that much vinegar.
Smith couldn't help a smile. I hope so. But at least I was polite.
Hagaru-Ri, December 5th, 2:30 p.m. He had promised the reporters a news conference. There were few secrets to protect, the operation in front of them straightforward. Litzenberg would lead the way south while Murray's men did what they could to sweep the enemy away from the east hill, protecting the march from the rear.
Around him now, Colonel Ridge's perimeter had been enormously strengthened, the Marines in Hagaru Re numbering nearly 10,000 effectives. The Chinese had seemed completely aware that any assault now would be even more costly than their attacks thus far, and so the enemy was keeping mostly quiet. The one primary sticking point for the position at Hagaru Re was the East Hill, where enemy troops continued to make themselves a dangerous nuisance. It would be Murray's job to sweep them away, removing eyes as well as guns from the best vantage point the Chinese now had. As long as the Chinese seemed content to hang back, the movement out of Hagaru Re might not be as dangerous as what the commanders had already dealt with at Udom Ni. And if the Chinese made an effort to attack the town, Smith had planned on heavy air support, the Corsairs and Air Force planes poised to blanket the enemy's positions. Any aggressive assault by the Chinese would have to absorb the kind of firepower the Chinese had seemed increasingly unwilling to chance. He moved across the frozen ground, his boots cracking the thin sheet of ice that seemed to drape over every surface. The entire convoy from Udom Ni was now safely in Hagaru Re, and Smith had ordered them to rest and refit as much as possible, allowing both Murray and Litzenberg 48 hours to put their men back into shape. With the refit, including weapons and warm weather gear, was the matter of distributing the replacements who had been flown up from Hung Nam, close to 600 men now, rebuilding the platoons and companies that had lost so many of their number. The newly healed wounded would, of course, return to their units, while the new men would be assigned where they were needed most. The able survivors from Don Faith's command had been formed into a temporary battalion numbering close to 400 men. Smith had no idea how effective those men might be in a fight, and already there were rumblings among some of the Marine officers that the Army troops should simply be kept out of the way. Smith would entertain none of that, knew that these men had seen the worst a war can be, most of them losing friends as well as commanders. There had always been the friction between the services, and now Smith began to hear that many of the Marines were unhappy marching alongside the soldiers, many of Faith's men offering no enthusiasm at all for another stiff fight. But Smith had no patience for squabbles. The soldiers were still capable, had been regrouped and rearmed, and, in the campaign Smith had planned, their numbers were certainly needed. If they were unwilling to fight on, that was a mindset Smith couldn't fathom. He thought of Amon's last boasting pledge as the man moved out toward his small plane. "I'll give you all the B-17s and B-29s you need. We'll open up a clean path all the way to the ocean." Smith felt a growl inside of him, thought, Amund looked like he was about to break down and cry, as though there was some kind of gooey sentiment attached to such an offer. I suppose that's how he thinks. It's all so simple. Bombs and big guns and the enemy will melt away. Victory just like that. Have none of them learned what kind of enemy this is? I wonder how many of these newspaper people think the same way. He was astounded to learn just how much press coverage the plight of the Marines was receiving in the States, that every news report began with the certain doom that was swallowing the 1st Marine Division. So, he thought, if it's not MacArthur telling them we've won this thing, before it even began, it's MacArthur or someone else telling them that all is lost. Why don't those people wait until the story ends, one way or the other, before they tell the whole country how bad off we are? I suppose I'll get my chance to preach about that right now. He stopped, looked at the large tent, saw a team of MPs, eyes watching him, men doing their job. Smith hesitated another moment, thought, God, I hate interviews. If you have any further questions, I'll do my best to give you a straight answer. I expect all of you to board the planes by tonight and return to, well, wherever it is you came from. I do not need civilians marching alongside men under fire, and I assure you we will be under fire. We will begin our advance very early tomorrow morning.
Sir,
You use the word advance. Shouldn't we describe your next operation as a retreat, or perhaps simply a withdrawal? He detected a British accent, one of a half dozen reporters that had gathered in the larger tent.
We're not doing either one. Where the enemy is blocking our path, we will confront him. As you know, we are surrounded, and so we will have to fight our way out. I have issued attack orders to all my commanders. It just happens that this time we're advancing in another direction.
Within 24 hours, the reporters had made the best use of the wire services, telephone, and any other communication line that would carry their stories. Very soon after, the word filtered back to Smith's headquarters, various responses coming to him from the quote now attributed to him, a ringing cry that began to appear in headlines in every newspaper that carried the story. For Smith, the twist to his words was amusing, and unlike so many misquotes attributed to military commanders, he saw this one as positive. The language now was a bit raw for his taste, but the sentiment conveyed his message perfectly, a message that he intended more for his own men.
Retreat, hell! We're just attacking in another direction.
Chapter 36 Riley. Hagaru Ri, North Korea, December 6, 1950, 4:30 a.m. The bonfires had begun the day before, anything not carried off by the Marines and Army troops to be destroyed. The orders were specific and detailed. The order of march, the assignment for Murray's 5th to remain behind, long enough to prevent the enemy from striking at Hagaru Ri until the entire force had cleared the area. To the surprise of Riley and everyone around him, Fox Company was chosen to move out first, leading the way south, the point of the entire convoy. The trucks would follow, spread out all through the column of marching men, while up the hills to the right, Marines from the 7th's Charlie and Baker companies would clear away any Chinese troops who attempted to interfere. Above the road to the left, the Army's newly formed 7th Regiment, what remained of Task Force Faith, would tackle the job. If there were doubts about the Army's abilities in a fight, the orders had mentioned nothing about it. Immediately behind Fox Company, 4 Sherman tanks were fueled up and put into line, though in the deep freeze of the pre-dawn, the crews were struggling to fire up the engines. But the schedule was precise, and so, as the tanks finally coughed to life, the men of Fox Company were already moving out. The goal was to reach Chesty Puller's perimeter at Koto Ri, and in between lay elements of 5 Chinese divisions, with at least 9 roadblocks identified by reconnaissance planes. Riley was shivering, nervous energy, the cold filling his lungs as energizing as it was painful. He had never thought about going into combat again, the next time, but like most of Fox Company, he accepted that their job was not yet complete. No matter how many they had killed, no one believed the Chinese would simply turn around and go home. Within an hour of leaving the southern perimeter of Hagaru Ri, the Chinese made it very clear that they were still on the heights, and still intended to make a fight of it. Riley's arms were clamped tight against him, his breathing in hard bursts, no one talking. He kept behind Welch, his usual place in line, Morelli across from him. He had missed Killian immediately, the idiotic chatter that livened up any march. But the men close to him now were silent, some of those the replacements, nervous and excited men, who had welcomed the order to lead the way. He had met most of them, brief exchanges, and like the other veterans, Riley made very little effort to buddy up to anyone. Some of the new men were older, leftovers from World War II, many of those volunteering in response to the awful news that flowed across the pages of stateside newspapers. Their arrival at Hagaru Ri was mostly without fanfare, the grim acceptance of veterans that they were needed, warm bodies to fill the gaps left by so many casualties. The new recruits were wholly different, and Riley had seen too much of that already,
boisterous backslapping introductions from boys who thought they were men. But the weather offered a rude slap that the adventure for these new Marines was not what they expected. Very quickly, the new men appreciated the value of the heavy coats, and many did what Riley had done long before he reached Fox Hill, tossing away the helmet, relying instead on the wool hat and the hood of the parka to prevent frozen ears. It was mostly dark, the hint of dawn showing a gloomy blanket of fog over the hills around him. He kept his gaze downward, shielding his face from a steady spray of wind-blown snow. Another glorious day, he thought. Maybe it'll keep the Chinese in their caves. He had a new thought, sweeping away his optimism. Or maybe it will keep the corsairs from seeing anything on the ground. Christ, nothing glorious about that. There was scattered firing up the hill to the right. A brief exchange, silence now. He felt the jump in his chest, one hand gripping the rifle close beside him. Already? Maybe we woke him up. Surprise, Chinaman. Now get the hell out of our way. We got someplace better to be. He felt the weight of the excess ammo on his belt, in his pockets, thought, hope I ain't got to use it all up. The Thompson was gone, Riley relying again on the M1, much more useful at long range. He felt the tug of the fully loaded backpack, thought, it's only a few miles away, so why'd they tell us to load up with so much stuff? He thought of the fires again, understood why the supply officers had opened up the PX, offering the men as much as they could carry, free of charge. From bitter experience, the veterans grabbed up things they could eat and not the canned goods that turned quickly to blocks of ice. They had learned by now that candy was far more useful, thawing out in your mouth, and so they grabbed up enormous amounts of caramel and chocolate bars and, of course, Tootsie Rolls. He had scooped up as much of that as the others around him, encouraged by the supply officers. Like a Christmas sale at Sears, he thought. Half off. 1 hour only. Ruthie goes nuts for that. Not sure I'll ever want to look at another candy bar, even free ones. He could see glimpses of the hill to the right, like so many others, tall and wide, little cover but scrub brush and snowdrifts. He heard more firing up to the right, thought, that's supposed to be Charlie Company. He looked ahead, past Welch, Lieutenant Dunn's first platoon, already up past a curve in the road. He glanced up the hill again. Still nothing to see. Thought of the Chinese. They had to know we were doing this, he thought. They saw the bonfires, surely. We either burn that stuff or let them have it all. And that's probably not a good idea. I wonder if they know what a Tootsie Roll is. He heard the rumble of the tanks coming up from behind, saw a man moving back toward him, breathing a thick fog. It was the new CO, Lieutenant Abel, halting in the road, waving toward the lead tank. The tank slowed, and Abel climbed up onto the rear of the machine, dug out the intercom telephone, shouted something, still shouting as the tank rolled past Riley. Abel climbed up on the tank's turret, pounding angrily on the hatch, and Riley heard the words now. "Open the damn hatch, you jackass!" The tank stopped now, the hatch opening slightly, Abel's face down low, hot talk Riley couldn't hear. The lieutenant backed away, jumped down, and the turret began to turn, the big gun pointing out to one side of the road. Riley was curious, followed the aim, saw a small cabin barely visible against the hillside, a hint of movement there, and the tank's gun erupted, a loud thump. The cabin shattered in a fiery blast. Abel shouted out toward Welch. "Take your squad up there. Check it out. Eyes open." Welch called out, "First squad up the hill. Let's go." Riley followed, questions in his mind, a half dozen men moving with him. They ran quickly as the shoe packs would allow, Riley already gasping for air, the usual burn in his throat and lungs. They were there quickly, and he kept his eyes on Welch,
saw him pointing the Thompson toward the wreckage of the cabin. Riley saw the small fires, the remnants of the blast, and scattered through the wreckage, bodies of the enemy.
You heard the LT. Keep your damn eyes open.
Riley studied the Chinese soldiers, some of them in mangled pieces, was surprised to see two of them cloaked in American coats.
Hey, Sarge? You sure they're Chinese?
Welch pushed into the shattered timbers, reached down, rolled one man over, said,
They're chinks. I guess they've been souvenir hunting, too, he called out. Now listen up. You didn't even know these bastards were up here. Lieutenant Abel spotted them. They're just letting us pass by for now. Seen this before. They just watch us. Then when we think we're safe, they smack us from behind. Or the men behind us, the trucks, think we've cleared the way, and they get slammed from the flanks. Keep your eyes alert. It's full daylight soon.
Riley knew most of that was aimed at the new men, and he moved closer to Welch, a low voice.
Did you spot them?
Welch slung the Thompson on his shoulder.
Hell no. I was kind of enjoying the peace and quiet. I guess we got to figure they're out here on every damn hill. I suppose we owe the lieutenant for this one. They could have hit us hard.
Welch moved to another body, kicked it lightly.
That's why he wears the silver bar. Let's get back to the road. We're holding up the whole works.
The Chinese were firing from behind a burnt-out jeep, other wreckage blocking the road. Riley had rolled down low in the snowy grass, close beside the road, more firing coming down from the hill to the left. He pulled himself small, no cover at all, the chatter of machine-gun fire raking the road beside him. The men around him were returning fire, and Riley slid the M1 up to his shoulder, peered up carefully, then down flat again. The roadblock was just past a curve in the road, 200 yards away. In front of him, a loud shout.
Where's that damn tank?
More men were calling out, and Riley heard a loud grunt, too familiar. He turned that way, saw blood on the hood of the man's coat, a large rip across the back of the man's head. He felt a jolt, shouted out,
Corman! Not now. He's had it.
He knew the voice, Welch, sliding up close.
I saw him hit. He raised up his head, and I was just about to give him hell. The bullet went through him, hit me in the arm.
Who?
New guy. That Georgia cracker. Christ, this hurts.
Riley felt a burst of alarm, scanned Welch's coat.
Where? You hit bad? Do you need a corpsman? Don't think so. His brain slowed it down. My coat did the rest. Might have busted a bone. Let me see it. Go to hell. We got an enemy up there. Find somebody to shoot at.
A machine gun opened up on the heights above them. The icy road peppered again. Riley pulled himself in tight, felt Welch beside him rolling over. The Thompson fired now, then stopped.
Welch shouting, He's right above us, that clump of brush. Take him out.
The men on both sides of the road responded, a chorus of firing, and Riley saw the muzzle of the machine gun protruding from a brushy thicket. He slid the M1 up, aimed, fired, then again. The machine gun went silent, but he saw the grenade now, a high arc tumbling down, bouncing on the hard road. Others saw it as well. Shouts.
Grenade!
The blast sprayed him with hard dirt, and there was more rifle fire, another machine gun opening up from the roadblock ahead. Riley gasped for air, the cold forgotten, saw Welch's face, crusted with dirt and ice. Welch said,
You okay?
Riley took a long breath, said,
Think so. A few feet shorter and we'd have shared that grenade between us. Yeah. Where the hell is that tank?
The answer came now, behind them. The hard thump of the gun, a blast impacting the roadblock. Another came now, and in front of them a shout.
Up! Hit 'em!
The men began to rise, Welch up quickly, Riley beside him. In front of them, 2 dozen men surged forward, and Riley saw Kane moving to one side, the men in front of them falling flat, firing steadily. Kane stayed up in the road,
flattened out behind the BAR. There was more fire from another BAR, Kane joining in, and behind them, another hard thump from the tank. Riley kept on his stomach, just off the road, saw Welch rise, firing the Thompson. He aimed the M1, fired, no targets, just the blackened wreck on the road, movement beyond. The voice came again, from up in front. Go! They're running! The men rose up again, a hard scamper toward the roadblock. No enemy fire. Riley ran as quickly as he could, gasping cold air, Marines reaching the roadblock, firing farther down the road. He stumbled, cursed the clumsiness of the shoe packs, saw a body to one side, men low around it, kept moving. He was at the wrecked jeep now, collapsed to his knees, searched the slopes to both sides, saw men up on the high ridges, Marines pushing forward. Around him, the harsh order, "Cease fire! Save your ammo!" The rifles went silent, and he saw Abel peering up past the jeep. More men were coming forward, and Abel waved them out to both sides of the road. Behind Riley, the tank was rolling closer, and Abel squatted down behind the jeep, called out, "Good job! You've taken out your first roadblock. Gather up! Prepare to move out!" Riley thought of the dead man, saw Welch, said, "We should check on that guy, make sure he's not wounded." Welch pointed back, and Riley saw a pair of corpsmen slipping quickly between several downed men. "They'll figure it out. We got better things to do." "What was his name?" "I don't remember." Welch seemed to think for a long second, shook his head. "From Georgia. Talked with a mouthful of molasses. Just came in yesterday. They'll grab his dog tags." Riley looked back that way. A half dozen wounded, said, "Jesus, his first day? It happens, you know that." "Yeah, I guess." "How's your arm?" "Nothing. Hell of a bruise, probably. I guess I owe that fella something." A man jogged forward now, moved toward Abel, said, "Lieutenant, sir?" "What?"
"Sir, Lieutenant Dunn's dead, sir. Back there a ways."
Riley saw shock on Abel's face. Unexpected.
"Good God, you sure, son?"
"He's dead, sir. There's no doubt." Riley looked at Welch, who dropped his head, and Riley said,
"He made it out of Toktong Pass without a scratch. They said he was the only officer who did."
Welch said,
"So did we. No one's wearing a lucky charm out here."
Behind Welch, Abel said, "The trucks are moving up. Let's load up the casualties." They had marched more than 3 miles. More roadblocks, more casualties. Up on the ridges on both sides of the road, Riley could hear the firefights, some brief, some more intense. But the greatest distraction was the air cover, the Corsairs and other bombers unloading on pockets of the enemy wherever they were found. From the men down on the road, the blasts of rocket fire and fiery bursts of napalm brought cheers and outbursts of amazement from the new men. The aircraft hit the roadblocks as well, adding enormous firepower that swept away most of the enemy resistance. For most of the day, the fighting was brief and sporadic, the enemy content to strike quickly, then fall back, unwilling or unable to make a strong stand. As dark began to settle over the heights around them, Abel passed the word. The order had come from Litzenberg that the company was to keep going, advancing as much as possible, even in the darkness. Riley kept his eyes on Welch, the steady rhythm of his footsteps. There was little else to see, the roadside dotted with occasional huts and run-down farmhouses, most of them wrecked by artillery or torched by fire from the plains. For much of the day, the tanks had moved forward, leading the way, and Riley tried to feel comfort from that, but there were doubts as well. Some of the men kept close to the big machines, warmed by the stinking exhaust. For most, a welcome trade. Riley was too far back in line, and with the darkness settling in, he thought of the tankers, a job he never wanted. But now those boys are warm, he thought, and they're buttoned up tight. Not a bad place to be when you can't see a damn thing. Ain't seen much the Chinese have that can hurt those fellows.
as long as they keep their hatches closed. Wonder what they can see from inside the damn things. Or maybe they don't bother looking. They leave that to us. The fighting on the darkening ridges above had grown quiet, a surprise, especially with the planes returning to their bases. He saw Welch wave a hand, move off to one side of the road, the column slowing. Riley moved up beside him, felt the misery of cold, wet socks, said, "We gotta change socks, Sarge. We stopping for long?"
"Hell if I know. Something's up."
"Hey, what's that?"
Riley listened. Nothing. But Welch held up his hand, the men around him silent. Riley heard it now. A faint voice.
"Help! American!"
Welch pointed.
"There. Easy. Spread out."
Riley saw Abel now, the lieutenant moving closer to Welch.
"What is it?"
"Somebody in one of those huts, maybe. Not sure. Could be chinks."
The voice came again, slightly above the road, and Riley could make out the group of small huts, the voice more distinct.
"American!"
Abel said to Welch,
"Check it out. Careful. Those bastards speak English when they want to."
Welch began to climb off the road, the rest of his squad following. The call continued, high and faint, coming clearly from one of the huts. Welch moved that way, waved the others out in a wide formation, a quick glance at Kane. Welch whispered,
"Get up here. You see chinks. You unload that thing."
Kane moved forward, out to the left of Welch, the BAR held ready. Welch leveled the Thompson. Riley, up to the other side, the M1 pointing. Four more men out past Riley. He ignored them, kept his eyes on the darkened hut, dim light, an odd stink. Welch dropped down to one knee, still pointing the Thompson, said,
"Hey, you wounded?"
"Oh, God, American. Yes, help."
"So who's Ted Williams play for?"
"Red Sox. Red Sox."
"Who the hell are you?"
"Jim Kalin. Corporal. George 3-1.
Welch absorbed that, said,
"Come out."
"Can't. Can't walk."
Welch pointed at Riley, motioned him forward. Riley let out a cold breath, his heart pumping, crept forward, the rifle ready, pushed the muzzle into the opening of the hut. In the faint light he saw the man, lying up against one side of the small hut, bodies beside him.
"Thank God. Thank God."
Riley glanced around the hut. Nothing else.
Called out, "I got him."
Welch was there quickly. A glance at the man, then a hard shout.
"Corman!"
Riley moved to the man, the pungent stink overwhelming. Kalin stammering now. A pool of emotion.
"Oh, God. Thank you. Check these fellows. I think they're dead, but check."
The corpsman was there now, and Riley recognized him. Rebert, a long-time veteran. Rebert moved quickly, kneeling close to Kalin, said,
"Can you feel your legs? Are you wounded?"
"No. They busted me up good. Can't walk."
Riley bent low, one hand probing the other men, each one cold and stiff.
"Sorry, pal. They're gone."
Kalin said something, too low to hear, and Rebert said,
"Let's get him to the trucks. We'll have to carry him."
Welch moved in, Riley beside him. Welch calling out,
"Morelli, make yourself useful."
The kid was there now, breathing heavily, and Welch said to Kalin,
"It's okay, sport. We got you. How long you been here?"
They hoisted Kalin up from beneath his arms, a sharp cry.
"My legs! Oh, damn!"
Rebert said something unintelligible, and Riley could see him pull something from his mouth, a syringe.
"Here, this will help."
The needle went in, Kalin calming immediately, and he said,
"4 days? 5? Not sure. They gave me a couple potatoes to eat. I tried to help the others. Thought we'd all just freeze. They left us. Didn't come back.
They had him upright, Welch leading the way out of the hut, a fresh burst of cold enveloping Riley. They moved slowly down the hill, Kalin's legs dangling, dead weight. On the road, the column had continued to move, trucks in line moving slowly. Rebert called out, one truck stopping, a squeal of brakes, the group carrying Kalin to the rear of the truck. Riley saw inside, men with fresh wounds, two men laid out with sleeping bags over them. Abel climbed up, said, "Lift him up here." They hoisted Kalin into the truck, the man out completely now, a wounded man making space. Abel said, "How many more are there?" Welch said, "Just him, sir. Three more didn't make it." Behind Abel, one of the wounded men said, "Jesus, what happened to him?" Welch said, "He's been out here for days. Chinks left him behind. Try to keep him warm, okay?" The man examined Kalin, said, "Hey, pal, you're going to be all right now." "Holy cow, he's a Marine. What the hell's he doing out here?" Abel said, "He's part of Task Force Drysdale. Road up ahead is a mess. Burnt trucks, bodies all over the place. Let's move out." Abel jumped down, moved toward the front of the truck, tapped the passenger side door, the truck lurching forward slowly. Riley kept pace, the smell easing, replaced by the sharp chill from his breathing. They moved as quickly as Abel could walk, and Riley saw the rest of the platoon, familiar faces, men scattered out along both sides of the road. It was almost full dark now, and he heard low talk, caught a new smell, burnt vehicles, saw one group of men in a tight knot, Abel moving that way. "What's up?" The men made way, and Riley saw now bodies in a pile off the side of the road. They were white, crusted with snow, and naked. Abel knelt low, a small flashlight in his hand, said, "They've still got dog tags." "All right, let me grab one of the trucks. Somebody who's got room. Then we'll put them aboard." There were groans from some of the men, and Riley ignored that. Knew it had to be the new men. He studied the corpses for details. Wounds, long frozen, smears of dried blood. He thought of the Chinese wearing American parkas, thought, "They're wearing everything else, too." He was grateful for the darkness, no faces, and he looked toward the column of trucks, saw Abel in the road, halting one. The lieutenant moved quickly to the truck's rear, then waved the men closer. "This one." Riley bent low, flexed his fingers, slid his hands beneath one of the bodies. Other men joined him, Welch beside him, the men working together, lifting, the frozen bodies separating. They carried the first man to the truck, the corpse twisted, one arm extended, the body pushed up into the bed of the truck. Abel was in the truck, pulled the man as far back as there was room, more men bringing the next body, then the rest. Riley went back to the pile, but more men from the platoon had joined in, the dead all retrieved. He felt exhausted, the squishing cold in his shoe packs, miserable, and he felt for the spare socks tucked into his belt. Up ahead there was a burst of machine gun fire, flashes of light. The shouts came now, men scattering, a sharp blast erupting from the bed of a truck. The rifles began, the chatter of a BAR, the hillside across the road alive with flickers of light. Riley dropped down, rolled the M1 off his shoulder, crawled off the road, a narrow strip of grass. He backed into the slope, turned the rifle outward, another blast beneath another truck. The word in his mind, "Grenade!" The machine gun fire came down from the heights, streaks of green tracers, most of it pouring into the column of trucks. There were shouts, orders, the trucks moving again, then stopping, doors jerked open, men climbing up, new drivers answering the commands, "Keep moving!" A 6x rolled in front of him, and he saw men swarming around it, white coats, his brain screaming, "Chinese!" To one side a Thompson fired, spraying the side of the truck. The men in white tumbled down, another grenade erupting, the flash illuminating the scene. More Chinese troops moved out into the road, some of them trying to board the truck. The truck stopped again, one man firing a burp gun into the cab, and Riley fired, the man falling back. More rifle fire came from the edge of the road, the Chinese caught in a crossfire, some running away, still on the road, cut down. More were moving up the hill, a retreat, the BAR chopping men as they ran. Riley finding targets, emptying the clip. He rammed another into the rifle, sighted a man scrambling up the hill, the man stopping, his arm up, tossing a grenade. Riley fired, the man collapsing. A long second, the grenade erupting close by. The firing began to slow, but there were new flashes high on the ridge. The army troops engaging the enemy, intercepting the retreat of the Chinese from the road. Riley sat still for a long moment, thunder in his chest, his back against a slope of frozen ground. There was a chorus of screaming around him, shouted orders, panic, wounded men. One truck was burning, the fire lighting the entire scene, men working to pull wounded from the burning truck, and he felt a jolt of energy, stood, moved that way. There were a dozen men, some pulling the wounded away from the truck, others trying to get close, the fire now too hot, swallowing the truck. He felt helpless, weak, stared into the flames, stepped closer, past the bodies, the corpsmen working in a frantic rush, more wounded tended to. One man dragged to the side of the road, another laid beside him. Riley couldn't see that, wouldn't look at the faces, the wounds, his eyes on the flames, and he moved closer. Slow steps, drawn by the heat, the delicious warmth on his face. Throughout the night, the enormous convoy inched its way slowly south. As they had done so many times before, the Chinese positioned themselves for ambush or rolled down to the main road in a breakneck assault. The firefights continued. The Marines and the men of the Army's newly formed battalion shoving their way through pockets of the enemy. Not all the Chinese were spoiling for a fight. In many encampments, the Americans crept forward to find huddled groups of frozen enemy soldiers, men who had died because their orders kept them on the hills, waiting to confront an enemy they did not live to see. Many of those Chinese units were the same troops who had ambushed Task Force Drysdale, and were still occupying the heights above what the Marines now called Hellfire Valley. The signs of Drysdale's fight were still in evidence, scattered corpses from both sides, the hulks of wrecked vehicles, shoved aside now by the heavy equipment that cleared the way. By dawn on December 7th, the men of Fox Company could still see hordes of Chinese troops high up above them, but most of those troops were engaged with the Americans sent up the hills to find them. The fights continued, scenes of bloody, awful horror, the Chinese again driven back. The convoy was repeatedly struck, machine gun fire, mortar rounds, more destruction and more casualties. Some Chinese troops, positioned close to the road itself, close enough to lob grenades into masses of wounded or riflemen who only targeted the truck drivers. Throughout the morning, the convoy kept in motion, fits and starts, tanks and rolling artillery working to keep the enemy away. Behind them, in Hagaru Ri, the men of Murray's 5th engaged the enemy, a brutal and bloody fight that finally pushed the Chinese back, allowing the final battalion of Murray's regiment to join the convoy. The rear of the column continued to receive heavy assaults from the unending numbers of Chinese on the heights. Hard fights for the Marines that were aided again by the tanks and artillery, as well as brutally effective airstrikes. They left behind the smoking remnants of the base at Hagaru Ri, worthless now to the Chinese troops who swarmed into the supply depot, finding only heaps of ash from 100 bonfires. By late morning, the men of Fox Company reached their goal, leading the way for the entire convoy, passing through Chesty Puller's outposts that guarded the way into the next link in Oliver Smith's shortening chain, the town of Koto Ri. Chapter 37 Smith Koto Ri, North Korea, December 7, 1950. He stayed at Hagaru Ri until the operation was well underway, would not just leave the men behind until he was confident the Chinese around the base could do little more than throw themselves uselessly into Murray's guns. Once Litzenberg offered assurances that the leading elements of the convoy were certain to drive through the last of the enemy roadblocks, Smith and his staff officers boarded their own aircraft for the short journey to Koto Ri. Murray was confident that when it was safe for his last few units to join the march, they would have no difficulty holding off any enemy incursions from behind. As one of his final responsibilities, Murray would leave Hagaru Ri only after destroying as much of the airstrip as possible and any other asset the now empty base might offer. The Chinese would certainly swarm into the town, and if they chose to waste time searching through piles of rubble, that was fine with Smith. The convoy, numbering nearly 1,000 trucks, jeeps, and ambulances, was hauling everything of military value, including, of course, the vehicles themselves. To suggestions, especially from Tokyo, that the airstrip be used to evacuate the men by flying them out piecemeal, as had been done with the wounded, Smith offered a flat refusal. Abandoning the massive amount of equipment, including the artillery, tanks, and vehicles, would be a bonanza for the Chinese and a devastating morale crusher for Smith's troops. Smith knew there were desk jockeys in Tokyo sharing the doomsday sentiments of many of the stateside newspapers who regarded this campaign as a disastrous failure. But Smith would hear none of that. His newly celebrated battle cry, which still brought a smile, was, in his mind, completely accurate. This was not a retreat. It was an attack in another direction. To fly the men out, abandoning their equipment, would change that completely. As the men prepared for the march south, Smith heard the talk, the enthusiasm for accomplishing this new mission, no different than their enthusiasm for anything he had asked them to do before. He had no interest at all in suddenly taking that away. They had walked in, they would walk out. To more moderate suggestions that the men should take advantage of their transportation, riding the trucks instead of marching the 11 miles to Koto Ri, Smith understood what many staff officers in Tokyo did not, that packing trucks full of men, allowing them to sit still in frigid conditions, would drain away their ability to react to a crisis. If the journey was uncontested, the far more pleasant ride would make sense. But Smith had to anticipate that the Chinese along that 11-mile stretch would do all they could to crush the convoy, as they had already done to Task Force Drysdale. Any assumption that the Chinese would simply lie back was erased the first mile out of Hagaru Ri. To arguments that the convoy could make far better speed than the pace of marching men, Smith knew very well that the condition of the road, added to the misery of the weather, meant that speed was a luxury they wouldn't have. Smith knew that even in decent weather, the trucks would be easy pickings for Chinese mortars and machine gunners, his men crowded together, nothing more than ripe targets. Marching among the trucks meant better security for everyone in the convoy. He had thought of walking with the men, one of those morale boosters that sounded more effective than they truly were. In fact, the business of reorganizing the division, of planning the next phase of the operation, had to be well underway even before the men reached Koto Ri. Chesty Puller had already prepared a large command post for Smith and his staff, and now the engineers were tackling a problem farther down that Smith had anticipated for weeks. Some 3 miles south of Koto Ri, the Chinese had finally destroyed the bridge that spanned a deep gorge in Funchalin Pass, creating a major obstacle for the Americans once they began their next drive southward toward Hungnam. Smith was certain the Chinese would fortify the hills around the deep chasm, hoping to crush the Marines and Army troops as they bunched up, helpless to move. Smith had to wonder if the Chinese command truly believed the Americans would allow themselves to march full speed toward a nearly impassable roadblock, only to halt in a 10,000-man traffic jam while their officers scratched their heads, figuring out what to do next. But so far the Chinese had shown very little imagination in their tactics. By finally blowing the bridge, it was clear to Smith that the Chinese would continue to do what they had done now for weeks, full-on frontal assaults. By creating a difficult roadblock, the location of that assault seemed pretty clear. The solution to the challenge lay once more with the engineering team led by Colonel John Partridge, the man responsible for the extraordinary success in building the airstrip at Hagaru Re. This time, Partridge was faced with the task of rebuilding the bridge, assisted by the fortunate presence in Koto Re of a team of Army engineers led by Lieutenant George Ward. Ward had significant experience with the construction of treadway bridges, prefabricated steel spans with plywood platforms strong enough to support a tank. The gorge, nearly 30 feet wide, could be bridged easily once the right equipment was brought into Koto Re. On December 7th, while Litzenberg's men were still fighting their way south, the engineers received a total of 8 bridge sections, enough for 2 full bridges. The spans weighed nearly 2 tons each and were dropped at Koto Re by parachute, each span hauled by a C-119 flying boxcar. The next task was to clear the pass around the gorge of a formidable force of Chinese whose purpose was to prevent any kind of crossing at all. Koto Re, North Korea, December 7th, 1950.
Not sure where we're going to put them all. I guess I should have paid more attention to just how many people you already had down here.
Puller drank from a coffee cup, shrugged.
We'll manage. We've got tents ready, mess areas, medical teams. I assume we're not going to remain here for long. We can certainly supply the men by air as long as we need to, but I'm assuming you'd rather have the men go to the mountain than have the mountain brought up here.
Smith stared at the map, Puller's wisecrack slipping past him.
Do we know how strong the enemy is around that bridge?
Puller sat back, toyed with a half-spent cigar.
Plenty. My suggestion is to send the fresh troops I've got here down that way. Chin Hung Ni is about 7 miles below those hills. I can order my 1st Battalion there to move north. The enemy will be squeezed from both sides. Won't matter much how many there are. They can fight for those hills or die trying. We can grab those hills pretty easily, and once the enemy is out of the way, it's a clear shot to Chin Hung Ni. The convoys can push across the bridge pretty quick if there's nobody shooting at them.
Smith leaned back, one hand on the pipe in his mouth.
Just like that.
You don't agree? Smith appreciated Puller's total confidence, even if there could be a significant cost in casualties.
How secure is Chin Hung Ni?
Puller stabbed the cigar into his mouth, crossed his arms over his chest.
Right now my 1st Battalion is being relieved by some part of the Army's 3rd Division. That was always the plan. We didn't really think we'd be bringing everybody back down the same road we went up. You were so fired up about your people being spread out all over hell and gone. Now you're bitching because we're all rammed together?
Smith knew there was nothing angry in Puller's words, saw the rough hint of a smile.
Louis, I'm just doing my job. 10th Corps is going to pick apart every detail of this entire operation. Count on it. If there's one mistake, my backside is going to boil for it.
Now he saw anger, Puller's expression changing abruptly.
I won't put up with that crap. Not one bit. There hasn't been a campaign in any war in history where somebody didn't hunt up a scapegoat for anything that went wrong. But there's 15,000, hell, 20,000 fighting men gathering up in this place who would be happy as hell to tell those mush-brained bastards just what we've done here. You didn't give the orders that got us into this pickle jar. The newspapers, by Christ, they're telling the American people that this whole outfit is gone, wiped out. And you can believe that 10th Corps or those morons in Tokyo might still believe that. Or, since we're doing just fine, thank you, they're trying to figure out the best way to put perfume on a hog's ass and lead him in a parade down 5th Avenue.
Smith smiled.
couldn't help marveling at Puller's confused choice of words.
"What on earth are you talking about?"
Puller was fuming now, tossed the cigar into a large tin can. "One day I'm going to run this show, find a way to keep the damn politicians out of our nose hairs. Your problem, O.P.? You're a nice guy."
Smith glanced at the various staff officers, the command post part of an enormous hospital tent. The men had gathered, the junior officers keeping back behind the senior staff. But all eyes were on their commanders. Smith said,
"You have work to do, gentlemen?"
Bowser was sitting close by, grinning, his usual expression.
"Not really, sir. The boys are still coming in here, and Murray's people are on the march. Until they complete the trip and we can tally up our casualties, there's not much else that Colonel Puller hasn't already done for us."
Puller kept his arms crossed, grinned past a fresh cigar.
"See? Somebody needs to tell MacArthur that Marines aren't just sons of bitches. We know how to run a war, not just fight one."
From the far side of the tent, a pair of aides came forward, and Smith looked that way, said,
"What is it?"
They halted, a young sergeant speaking out.
"Sirs, the newspaper men are pushing pretty hard. They want to know details. The MPs are keeping them back, but they're mighty pushy, sirs."
The other man elbowed the sergeant, a sharp whisper.
"Oh, yes, that broad. She's pushy, too."
Smith looked at Puller.
"Maggie Higgins?"
Puller blew out a cloud of smoke.
"She said you'd authorized her being here. Pain in the ass."
Smith thought a moment.
"I've no patience for this crap, Louie. Here's what I'm authorizing. Put her on a plane, quick as you can, and send along anyone else you think is a pain in the ass. I tossed her out of Hagaruri already. This is too important, and we're too close to success here. I don't care about how good a reporter she is and the fact that she's a woman. She's a distraction, whether she likes that or not. Am I clear?"
He knew he didn't have to be that stern with Puller, the browbeating more for the rest of the staffs. Puller kept the cigar in his mouth, nodded.
"She's been pretty pissy about being treated differently because she's in a combat zone."
Smith was fully annoyed now.
"Bull! I'm treating her differently because there are 20,000 young men around here who haven't seen a good-looking woman in weeks, months maybe. She'll be the prime attraction, men stepping all over each other to get an interview. Or maybe just stare at her."
Puller shook his head.
"One reason I didn't give her too much grief is that she's so damn disagreeable all on her own, and I figured the boys would find that out themselves. She's already gone around interviewing wounded men, ignoring what kind of shape they might be in, like their damn misery isn't as important as giving her their full attention. More than one of the boys has fallen asleep while she's holding court. She might be pretty, but she's not making any friends here. Maybe this will teach her something about humility."
Smith was in no mood for this.
"Louis, she's already distracting you. How many reporters are here? A dozen? Name them. I can't. We're not here to humble civilians. If you're right, she cares more about her reputation than the boys she's talking to. Get her the hell out of here."
Puller nodded.
"Yes, sir."
Across the tent, more men were moving in, and Smith looked that way, had a nagging dread of some new disaster. The group moved his way, and Puller said,
"Those are Murray's boys. I know that, Major. Simmons."
Smith knew the man as well, stood, felt a surge of energy. They stopped, four men, ragged, dirty uniforms. The Major said,
"Sir, Colonel Murray is pleased to report that his lead elements have entered Koto Ri. I can verify that, sir. I led them."
Bowser stood, moved out to the far end of the tent, and Smith watched him for a long second, not certain where he was going. He looked at Major Simmons now, said,
"Welcome. How much difficulty did you have? We received several radio calls, a good bit of resistance all along the way."
"Yes, sir, there was. The air cover helped, and the artillery boys used those 105s in short-range combat, point-blank fire. Damnedest thing I've ever seen, sir. The enemy pushed hard all along the road, and we chewed him up pretty effectively. Smith couldn't avoid feeling nervous relief. "Major, there's warm food in a number of mess tents. Grab some if you like." The man smiled, and Smith saw the weariness, the grime on the man's bearded face. "Will do, sir." Bowser returned now, said, "Excuse me, sir, but I heard something odd. It sounded like singing. I checked on it." He looked at Simmons. "Major, I assume those are your boys out there?"
"Yes, sir. I can shut them up if you wish."
Bowser seemed apologetic now.
"Oh, no, I was just curious. They're singing some pretty, raw stuff."
Simmons smiled now, his pride showing through. "Colonel, the men are quite accomplished in adding their own lyrics to some pretty dull songs. Colonel Murray encourages it." Smith was curious, looked at Bowser.
"I'd like to know what they're singing."
"You sure, sir? It's rather amazing just how profane, well, you know, sir."
Smith laughed, knew Bowser was too efficient at protecting him. "Colonel, I assume they have chaplains who've heard this stuff. If it's all right by them, it's all right by me."
Simmons spoke up now. "Actually, sir, it's a couple of the chaplains who wrote the stuff." The fighting around Funchalin Pass began early on December 8th, made more difficult for both sides by a vicious snowstorm that limited visibility and movement. Worse for the Marines, the storm kept their air cover away. But Puller's suggestion and Smith's plan for squeezing the Chinese between two halves of a vise proved enormously effective. By dawn on December 9th, with the weather clearing, the Chinese had either been wiped out or had withdrawn on their own from the site of the destroyed bridge. With the word coming back to Koto Ree of the successful push, the engineers took over. By 4 that afternoon, the lead vehicles of the enormous convoy began crossing the bridge. After a temporary delay caused by a near disaster for one of the heavier bulldozers, the bridge was made fully passable. Throughout that night, nearly 1,400 vehicles and most of the Marine and Army troops made their way across the span. Puller's final responsibility at Koto Ree was to perform the same task Murray had accomplished at Hagaru Ree, keeping the Chinese away from the perimeter of the base until the convoy had cleared the area. In the process, the airstrip successfully evacuated some 600 new casualties, most of those from the fighting they had endured on the journey down from Hagaru Ree. With the perimeter of Koto Ree secure and the crucial bridge fully operational, Smith knew it was time once again to move his command post south, this time returning to the port of Hung Nam, the exact location where his headquarters had been established when this campaign had begun. He boarded the helicopter, watched as Bowser led a half-dozen men toward an idling C-47. His pilot was unfamiliar, Smith absorbing a slight jolt of discomfort from that. But the young man smiled at him, said, "On your command, sir." Smith pulled the coat tightly around him, pointed upward, the pilot revving the engine, the chopper rising quickly. They topped the tallest structures, the pilot turning, aiming south, and Smith felt a tug, a hard pull inside of him. He put a hand on the young man's arm, said,
"Over that way, past the tents, just a few seconds."
The pilot obeyed, the chopper swinging around, easing slowly over the encampment. Smith looked down, saw crews of Puller's men gathering up everything worth carrying, loading it on the vast rows of trucks. The pilot looked at him, uncertain, and Smith kept his eyes on the ground, pointed ahead, the chopper sliding farther along, no more than 100 feet above the ground.
"Sir, the enemy's been raising Cain with every aircraft flying out of here. We go much closer to those hills. We're pretty sure to take fire."
Smith ignored the caution, searched, held a hand up now.
"Hover right here."
The chopper slowed, and Smith saw the freshly churned ground, already frozen, an enormous grave.
We had to leave some men here, son. 113 of them. Buried them right there. The airstrip wasn't adequate to fly them out. I hate that. Hate it with every bone in my body. We'll get them out one day. I promised them. We'll get them out.
The pilot looked at him with wide eyes, nodded slowly. Yes, sir. I'm certain of it, sir.
Smith kept his eyes on the mass grave, felt a sickening twist in his stomach. We'll get 'em out.
Chapter 38. Sung. Northeast of Hagaru Ri, December 10, 1950. There were six prisoners, bandaged and crippled, huddled together in a small hut. Two of Sung's men guarded them, showing more menace than the prisoners required. Sung, aware it was more for his benefit than for any threat that these men would attempt escape, he studied them as they studied him, caked filth on bearded faces, bloody clothing, rags wrapped on their feet. Sung looked at the aide beside him, said,
"What happened to their boots?"
The man shook his head.
"I do not know, sir."
Sung thought, "Well, I know. Whoever captured them took their boots and anything else of use."
"Have we been able to speak with them?"
"None of them speak Mandarin, sir. Our interpreter, Mr. Hong, has not been seen in several days. We believe he deserted."
Sung looked at the man.
"Where would he go, Colonel? He would join these men? Fight against us?"
"I do not know, sir."
"I hear those words far too often, Colonel. What do we know of these men? They do not appear to be Marines."
"They admit to being American Army. We understood that much from what they said."
"Two of them carry wounds."
"Yes, sir. We treated them as best we could. We have very little to offer our own wounded."
"That is not a reason to ignore the treatment of prisoners. Have their wounds cleaned, bandaged again." "We are not war criminals, Colonel Liu."
"Yes, sir. Right away."
Liu backed away, moved quickly toward the medical area, and Sung dropped to one knee, looked hard at the faces, eyes staring sharply at him. He saw fear as much as anger, was gratified by that. He fought for the words, the scattered English he had absorbed so many years before.
"Your war is past. You will be freed soon. I do not need to keep you."
He waited for a response, the men perking up a bit to his words. One man nodded toward him, a hesitant, "Thank you."
"You may speak. We want no secrets from you. We offer you only sanctuary. You are no different than us."
He stopped, struggled to find the words he sought.
"You do not have to fight for your warlords, men who get rich on your blood. You do not have to fight for the generals, for your government. You can return to your army. Spread this joy. There will be a new war, the people fighting the government. Tell your soldiers, your friends, they can end this war if they turn their guns to their own officers."
Their expressions did not change, but one man took a long, grimacing breath, said,
"Go to hell."
Sung waited for more, saw nothing coming from the others. He stood again, saw defiance from them all, a surprise. Liu returned, one of the medical men in tow. Sung watched the doctor go to the first prisoner, a clean bandage in his hand, but the soldier pulled away, angry words too fast for Sung to understand. The doctor tried again, the prisoner protesting loudly, slapping the man's hand away. The doctor looked at Sung now, said,
"What do I do, sir? They will not allow me to treat them."
"Doctor, treat them when you can. They become weaker
or their pains become greater, they will allow it. We shall release them when it is appropriate to do so.
Sung spoke to the men again in his rough English.
We will not harm you. We are not your enemy.
The first prisoner looked up at him, said, I told you to go to hell. Behind Sung, Colonel Liu said,
They must believe we are poisoning them, or torture, perhaps. Your orders were clear, sir. We have already returned a number of prisoners who were well cared for. Surely their soldiers will understand that we mean them no harm, that this struggle is for all soldiers. How do we teach them of the revolution, sir? How do we make them understand? Colonel, you must have faith in the revolution. These men will remember how we treated them, and they will return to the abuse of their masters. We have planted a seed in them. It is all we can do.
He paused, studied the men again.
But I admit, I thought it would be easier convincing them.
South of Hagaru Ri, North Korea, December 11th, 1950.
Sir, this way.
He nudged the horse over the snowy trail, followed the man's wave, saw the cave now. All along the climb he had passed bodies, nearly all of them his own. He tried not to see that, but the horse saw it for him, stepping gingerly through the frozen rocky ground, avoiding the snow-covered corpses. The cold was relentless, and he pulled himself into his coat, a futile effort to keep the wind away. Behind him, staff officers rode as he did, while out to both sides, a company of guards climbed on foot, keeping themselves in formation, a veil of protection. The guide motioned again, pointed, and Sung climbed down from the horse, handed the reins to his aide. The guide waited for him, stood aside, the opening of the cave partially blocked by a pile of rocks and rubble, someone's attempt to add cover. He hesitated, staring into the ragged maw of the cave, then dipped his head slightly, moved inside. The cave opened up to a wide hollow, some of that man-made, the preparation his men had labored over to keep hidden from the American aircraft. He blinked in the darkness, just enough light to see why they had brought him here. The cave was filled with soldiers, nearly 30 or more, an entire platoon, their weapons stacked neatly to one side. Some appeared to be sleeping, pale white faces, others staring ahead. All had their legs pulled up tightly, were huddled close together, their quilted coats embracing each man, the customary flapped hats on their heads. He studied them, expected any one of them to suddenly acknowledge him. The usual deference, a respectful salute. But they stayed silent, none of them moving at all. Nothing in their eyes but frozen death. He backed out of the cave, stood for a long moment, thought, we must mark this place. It would be easy to forget this hill, this cave. Now it is a tomb, and we shall be respectful of that. He looked up past the opening, the hill wide and steep, rocks and frozen scrub. He looked back toward his horse, his aides waiting for him, and he moved that way, said to anyone who could answer him, Are there more caves on this hill? No one responded, and he knew it was a foolish question, that very likely the only men who knew of the caves were the men who had sought out their protection, and if there were more like this one, they too had become tombs. He climbed up on the horse, the aide handing him the reins, no one speaking. Among the staff was a young captain, a man who had been punished by his colonel because he had lost his soldiers, unable to explain what had happened to his command. Sung had been nearby, making the slow, plodding ride down the valley to Koto Ri, had interrupted the colonel's tirade. A threat of execution screamed into the terrified captain's face. It was an overreaction from an officer who surely carried some blame himself. One small failure in a vast campaign of failure. Sung had stopped, inquired, the young captain begging him for leniency, offering an explanation that the colonel had tossed aside with a self-conscious smugness. But Sung saw something of substance in the captain, a story that offered more of tragedy than incompetence, and so he had made the climb up the great hill, led by one of the captain's men, a witness ignored by the colonel. And now the story was confirmed. He looked toward his aide, said,
"Colonel Liu, release the captain. He may return to his command."
He looked at the young captain now.
"Do you still have a command?"
The young man did not look at him, kept his eyes downward.
"Sir, I have only 6 men from my company. There are others who died in the night and the night before. The storm caught us on the march. We were already down to 60 men. They performed admirably, sir. I regret I could not prevent their loss."
"So do I. You may go."
"I shall inform your colonel that you are without blame. If he wishes to find fault for our losses, he may express that to me. The blame is mine."
Koto Ri, North Korea, December 11, 1950. The fires were still burning all throughout the town, and he moved into a wide square, the wreckage of what had been a hospital. The stink was putrid, burning bandages and bedding, a smoldering mass of gauze and linens and too many things he did not need to identify. He dismounted the small horse, walked slowly toward a scattered heap of empty steel barrels. Gasoline, he thought. What they didn't require for their trucks, they could use to ignite their fires, to destroy anything of use. I suppose I would have done the same. Down one of the narrow avenues of the town, men were gathering, a cluster of quilted uniforms, poking through more of the rubble. They seemed cheerful, boisterous talk, and he watched them for a long moment as they found small treasures. One man made a loud noise, held up what seemed to be a large hammer, the others saluting him, then returning to their own search. He was curious just why they were so joyful, but stayed away, would allow them to continue searching. They have very little, he thought. Perhaps they will find food somewhere in this wreckage. Weapons we have in abundance, even if our ammunition runs low. Does that matter? There is no longer an enemy. The staff kept back, knew him well, that when he was like this, pensive, silent, he was not to be interrupted. But the Russian had no such tactfulness, dismounted a horse of his own. Sung avoided looking at him, a spectacle of opulence in his thick fur coat. "But he will offer his opinion," Sung